Hi everyone, Roger Browning here again. This week's discussion is going to focus on life-threatening bronchospasm and how to use safe mechanical ventilation. Before I get into the guts of the topic, a shout out to the Intensive podcast and intensiveblog.com, which is run by some doctors from the Alfred Intensive Care Unit in Melbourne, and a really great talk by David Tuckson on this topic. I thoroughly recommend it. And there's a little bit of discussion in there which I found fascinating about the thunderstorm asthma crisis they had in November last year in 2016, where there were 9,000 presentations over 24 hours and 9 deaths in Victoria. So really interesting, really detailed discussion of the physiology, and interesting and educational. Also, a quick shout out to another website which I found useful putting this together, called Deranged Physiology, which is run by a bloke called Alex Yartsev, who I believe is also an intensive care doctor over in Victoria. Okay, so I thought we would focus this discussion on one aspect of bronchospasm, which is safe mechanical ventilation. Anyone who's ever looked after a patient with severe bronchospasm and had to use mechanical ventilation on them will know that it's a pretty scary set of situation, and there's a few serious things that you can do wrong and cause some serious harm. So that's the whole message behind this podcast, is to revise that and perhaps give some tips to remind everyone how to do this safely. Not going to go into depth in the physiology, but basically most of you should know this, but this is relevant to how we do this safely, is understanding the major pathophysiological change in asthma, which is that air or gas can get in, but it can't get out very easily. And so expiration is the issue. And the main thing you want to avoid where you can cause serious harm is called a condition known as dynamic hyperinflation, also called gas trapping or breath stacking. Basically, what happens is the ventilation is excessive and there's not enough time allowed for expiration. So after you give a breath, before that breath has been fully expired, you're already giving the next breath. And this leads to a sort of staircase phenomenon where eventually the patient's chest becomes hyperinflated. This can cause, obviously, trauma to the lungs, but the most serious complication is the cardiovascular compromise, which can occur. The hyperinflated lungs, it causes compression of the pulmonary circulation, meaning that blood can't flow through the pulmonary vessels and capillaries, leading to decreased cardiac output and then eventually cardiac arrest. And I also believe there is an element of actual physical anatomical displacement of the heart by these hyperinflated lungs, causing basically cardiac tamponade as well. So that's the situation that can occur. Obviously, hyperinflate something too much, it can cause tension, pneumothorax, and various other things too. Okay, so in order to sort of structure this discussion, I have put together a little fictitious obstetric case, which you can read if you're on the website. In summary, a woman developed severe bronchospasm following an injection of intramuscular carbaprost, which she receives because she has an atonic uterus and is having a postpartum hemorrhage. Obviously, there are varying degrees of bronchospasm. Hopefully, the patient is not compromised enough that you need to intubate them. And that is probably, I guess, one of the things that we should start off with, is that, you know, intubating and mechanically ventilating someone with bronchospasm is not a decision you should take lightly. And this, because of all this serious adverse events which could occur. In this fictitious case, I have made it pretty obvious that that's required. You know, she basically becomes unresponsive and hypoxic despite your best efforts. So how would you induce, first question I've got is, how would you induce anesthesia? Don't want to spend too much time on that, because I don't think that's where most of the money is in this talk. If it's not immediately life-threatening and you've got time, but you still think you're going to need to put them on a ventilator. I guess the ideal induction agent would be ketamine, in that it is cardiovascularly stable and has some bronchodilation properties. If you push for time, the patient's literally stopping, resting in front of you, then you may or may not have time to choose what drugs to use, but a bit of propofol is usually available, some sort of muscle relaxant if required. Once you get the tube into place, you know, how are you going to set up the ventilator and safely ventilate this woman? Now, I'm going to go through a list of key points that I think you should try and remember when setting up the ventilation. It might not be easy to remember all these in a crisis, so I think the underlying principle that you need to remember is basically you want to have plenty of time for expiration. So whatever you set up, as long as you give the patient plenty of time to expire and you aim for really what is quite small minute ventilation and tidal volumes and respiratory rates, so that you're not going to cause dynamic hyperinflation, you probably won't go wrong. However, let's go through the, if you want to be an expert in this, the key things that you probably should try and remember. So, the first thing I've written down is use volume control ventilation. So basically the principle is you're going to try and give plenty of time for expiration. That means you need to get the inspiration in relatively quickly. And this is quite difficult if you're going to use pressure control ventilation in the pressure control waveform. Experts in this area recommend volume control ventilation. You know, want to aim for a small tidal volume, 5 to 7 mils per kilo. So that's in your traditional 70 kilo average person, 350 to 500 mil tidal volumes. And you want a low respiratory rate. So they talk, the authors of most guidelines talk about 10 to 12 breaths per minute. But I would must admit that when I've had bronchospasm, I've aimed even lower than that. You know, better off to start lower, I think, and then maybe titrate it up if you think it's safe. And just tolerate a low minute ventilation. Don't worry about the CO2. You're going to cause harm and or death by hyperventilating them, so don't worry about that CO2. It is going to climb. In order for a patient to tolerate this high CO2, you're going to need to, it's going to be a very strong drive in the CNS to breathe, so you're going to have to sedate and usually paralyze them, especially initially. So feel free to use those things liberally. So once you've set all that up, you want to make sure, check on your ventilator, that you've got at least 4 seconds for each expiration. And you're going to need to adjust the IE ratios often to between 1:3 to 1:4. Some ventilators you might be, to change that, you might not have it that setting, and you actually adjust the inspiratory flow rates. So turn the inspiratory flow rates up high. All of these things are going to lead to high peak inspiratory pressures because you're trying to give the breath in over a short period of time. So you're going to have to reset the alarms to allow this to occur. So you tolerate high peak inspiratory pressures. What you don't want are high peak plateau pressures, which is the actual pressure in the alveoli. And hopefully most of us we'll have some idea of how to measure that. It's easier on intensive care ventilators usually. There's a button you can push and it will measure that for you. But basically you have an inspiratory hold, so you hold the breath. At the end of expiration, the breath is held for a second or two. This allows you to measure the peak plateau pressure. Make sure that's less than 25 centimetres of water. All right, finally, PEEP. Most people recommend no PEEP at all. Or if you are going to give some PEEP, only minimal amounts. Because basically with this dynamic hyperinflation that most asthmatics have, they have a degree of intrinsic PEEP. And any external PEEP that you apply on with your ventilator settings is really basically just going to be pushing the mean intrathoracic pressure up a little bit more. And obviously that's the thing you don't want to occur. Alright, so I didn't really go through what is the treatment of dynamic hyperinflation, but that comes up next. So as you can see in my fictitious case that we have here, I have described someone who's got caught up in after intubation, caught up in the adrenaline rush that usually occurs in something like this, and the patient is hypoxic and they're trying to fix that, and inadvertently they have set the ventilator to quite a vigorous settings, 700 mL by 16 breaths per minute and a high PEEP. So, number three, I've said After a few minutes, suddenly the patient has no pulse. What has happened? What is the differential diagnosis and what are you going to do? So I think I've already explained that the thing you're really trying to avoid, and which has probably occurred in this situation, is dynamic hyperinflation. There's a few other things that could be. It could be a tension pneumothorax, or it could be displacement of your airway and things. We'll go over that in a second. But what's the first thing you should probably do, because it's highly likely that dynamic hyperinflation is the cause, is what's known as an apnea test. So anyone who's on a ventilator because of bronchospasm, if you have cardiovascular compromise or collapse, the first thing you should do while you're trying to sort out everything else is disconnect them from the ventilator and even apply pressure manually to the chest to try and squeeze some air out. And you may have to do, well, most people recommend doing this for at least 90 seconds, which would in real life seem like an awfully long time if you've got a hypoxic sick patient in front of you. But basically what happens is the gas that has been trapped will come out, the pressure in the chest will fall, venous return will resume, and hopefully the PEA or electromechanical dissociation, which has been occurring, will resolve and the patient will have a pulse and a blood pressure. And usually, I have actually seen this when I worked in emergency medicine 20 years ago, well, not quite that long ago, but before I did anaesthetics, I did see someone get hyperventilated, a COPD patient, to the point where this did occur, and someone much more senior and clever than me realised what was happening and did the apnea test, and it worked a treat. So there you go. Okay, so what if you do the apnea test and things don't get better? Well, you've got to make sure you've got the diagnosis right. So, especially in less clear-cut cases, is this actually bronchospasm? You know, sometimes when you have problems with a patient on the ventilator and maybe they're a heavy smoker and asthmatic, you think straight away you just sort of jump to the conclusion that they've got bronchospasm. Don't forget, there are other things that can cause higher respiratory pressures and patient compromise. So check your machine, your circuit, the tube. Make sure there's no problem. There's no biting of the tube. There's no kinking of the tube. There's no mucus plugs. Have a look in the mouth of a laryngoscope. They haven't coughed it out. The tube hasn't become displaced. Disconnect the machine completely from the patient. Maybe it's the machine problem. Check with a bag. Ventilate them with a bag manual ventilation device. See if it feels normal. Partial suction catheter or bronchoscope through the ETT. All of those things should help you make sure you're not missing something. What about tension pneumothorax? This is a difficult one. Probably something that you could devote a whole discussion to, so we can't really go into that, but certainly as a potential, if you've been ventilating a bronchospastic patient with high pressures, this is definitely something that could happen. The correct management, I'm not sure that I know what that is. There are various options. You know, do you have time? Is a patient stable enough or that you can actually get some imaging to confirm it? Because blindly putting needles or cannulas into the chest, if you're not sure of a diagnosis, is probably fraught with danger. If they didn't have a pneumothorax beforehand, you're probably going to cause one. Obviously, you just put in a chest drain. That's not a bad thing to do, but it usually takes time to get hold of that equipment. What about ultrasound? Is that really useful in a bronchospastic patient where the lung's not moving much anyway? So those are all issues to think of. And even manual finger thoracostomy, you know, that's less quick and easy to do, but I've never done it myself. So anyone got any comments there or experience or thoughts, that would be really interested to hear them. So I think that's mainly what I wanted to discuss. I am going to briefly discuss, though, for a couple of minutes, bronchodilation and the fact that she's probably still bleeding, because that's the reason she's in theatre. So the mainstay of treatment is going to be salbutamol or beta-2 agonists. How are you going to give that? In my experience, when I've had a patient who's bronchospastic on a ventilator, I have just used the special connection device which comes with the Ventolin canister. And I, extremely liberal, spraying at least 20 sprays of salbutamol into the circuit, because most of it ends up on the tube. I think that's the safest and the easiest way to administer a large amount of salbutamol to a patient. A lot of it's not going to get into their lungs. You may have to resort to some form of parenteral beta-2 agonist if you are familiar with and know how to give salbutamol. If you have it available, I know maybe even tobutylene if you work in an obstetric hospital that has that. you can give that intramuscularly or subcutaneously or intravenously. I personally must admit that we don't usually have it in the place I work, and it's certainly not in theatre, so if I had to give something parenterally, I might have to give a dose of intramuscular adrenaline or very small boluses of intravenous adrenaline, but I would only recommend doing that if you are familiar with it. Downside, obviously, of adrenaline is the alpha agonism and the hypertension that can occur. Oxygen, anticholinergic, steroids, all of those things are useful to add. And certainly if you are in theatre and you have a vaporizer, I would highly recommend giving a little bit of volatile of some sort, because this is a potent bronchodilator. Not an option if you're using a transport ventilator or you're in intensive care where they don't have that as part of the circuit. Other things that people have used, I'm not going to go into detailed discussion, include ketamine, magnesium, etc. And finally, if nothing's working, you're at the end of your exhausted the end of your list of options to try and rescue this patient. If you're lucky enough to be in a hospital which has the ability to perform ECMO, there are definitely case reports of patients who have had good outcomes when they have had ECMO applied to rescue them from what is otherwise a dire situation. Alright, so I think I've covered most of the things. Hopefully you find this useful, either as revision, for I know a lot of people know this already, or maybe picked up a few points like I did when I was reading up for this. I've talked about it specifically in an obstetric case, but basically any useful in any situation where you have someone with bronchospasm, especially, obviously, I guess the scariest one is someone with a severe exacerbation of asthma. But even I must admit, some of the worst bronchospastic episodes I've had have been unexpected anaphylaxis, which is also, so you need to use all the same principles. Really keen to hear people's comments and suggestions for other topics to go over, and if anyone wants to contribute, let me know. Okay, thanks for listening, and bye, see you next time.